Welcome to the fourth meeting of the 22nd season of the Harvard Law School Forum. Tonight, our topic is abortion. Our panelists are the Honorable Albert Blumenthal, the Reverend Robert F. Drinan of the Society of Jesus, and Dr. Alan Guttmacher. Dr. Alan Stone is our moderator. On Friday, February 23rd, Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee and Senator William Spong of Virginia will discuss the two-party South. And on Saturday, March 9th, Malcolm Muggeridge visits the forum. On Friday, March 15th, Bishop Pike comes to Cambridge. In keeping with the theme of this program, I'd like to present a monologue. If you are wondering why this program is on a Monday, it is because the forum has declared it a Friday. Welcome to our Christmas program, where we pay tribute to one unmarried pregnant woman who is able to get along without aborting the child. While we try for balance in our programs, we admit that tonight's panel actually has only one side represented, those who live. This is just another example of how people who don't know the law and have no lobby lose out. For those of you who are interested, North Carolina has the shortest residency requirement, and air service from all major cities is excellent. You must stay there 4 months, which of course means that you should go before the conception. Paul VI recently suggested colonization to the Indian ambassador. But when this didn't work for Japan, they promoted abortion, and in the 1950s showed the fastest drop in the birth rate ever experienced by a civilized nation. The legal implications of such a move by the United States are numerically astounding. Justice Douglas, in throwing out the Connecticut birth control law, pointed to the 1st, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 9th, and 14th Amendment as involved. The privacy surrounding the marriage relationship, according to Justice Goldberg, has best been stated in the 9th Amendment to the Constitution, which reads, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people." The Model Penal Code would allow abortion where two doctors certify either risk to the physical or mental health of the mother, or risk of a physically or mentally deformed baby, or rape or incest. This topic will be of more concern to the law school next year if Louis Hershey's suggestion is followed and we have an all-female student body. We are especially proud of our panel. Fresh from his work on the New York State Constitution, Mr. Blumenthal comes here to tackle the topic of abortion. Besides co-sponsoring... Besides co-sponsoring a bill to permit therapeutic abortions in New York State, he has proposed a housing rehabilitation plan. We understand that builders under that plan would not be allowed to build apartments with more than 2 bedrooms. Dr. Guttmacher pointed out to me the contradiction in the title, for as we know, with abortion there is no issue. Father Drinan pointed out that this problem will eventually be solving itself when there are only Catholics left. We apologize for Father Drinan being in uniform. We had planned for all our panelists to be in plain business suits and for the audience to guess who was who. But Father Drinan indicated that in these times there was a real chance people might think he was leaving for good. Dr. Alan A. Stone, M.D., graduated from the Yale Medical School. He is a professor at Harvard Medical School and at Harvard Law School. At the law school, he teaches 2 courses with Professor Dershowitz. He teaches psychoanalytic theory and legal assumptions and the prediction and prevention of antisocial conduct. He has written 2 books, Longitudinal Studies of Child Personality and The Abnormal Personality Through Literature. He is a native of Boston, but nevertheless a psychoanalyst. He is currently preparing a report on psychiatric aspects of abortion. May I present a man who welcomes this opportunity for group analysis, Dr. Stone.
Mr. Sawyer's intention is to leave the panel speechless, but this panel will not be denied. I've already had several suggestions. One, what is a psychoanalyst doing in this spot anyway? Two, let's skip all the emotional issues and get to the metaphysics. I won't tell which one of the panel made that suggestion. But I'm going to try and give you some, to live up to my profession, some free associations. They're not really free associations. They're rehearsed free associations. What do people think of when they think of abortion? Or at least what do I think of? Infanticide, feticide, murder, playing God, meddling with creation. Is it a life? I think of criminal abortion, women dying, getting infection, sterility. Who's going to defend the embryo? What about the sanctity of life? What kind of doctor does criminal abortion? How do they do it? It must be awful. Why should she have to have a baby? Her life is ruined anyway. The shame of it all. If they can get away with that, the next thing will be euthanasia. What will it do to sexual morality? Why do they need it when they have the pill already? She'll hate herself forever. She'll hate the baby. Well, in 100 years, there won't be room to sit down anyway. So I guess we had to come to something like this. But who will decide? You know, when you think about it honestly, it could have happened to me. Now, a brief reprise from the rational side. Looking at some of the statistics, that's always rational. Abortion has been practiced in virtually every society known to man. Let's look at the birth rate in the United States. It's approximately 4 million a year. Now we have estimates for the criminal abortion rate. They range from Andre Heliger's, a professor at Johns Hopkins Medical School, who says something under 100,000 a year. They go up to Alice Rossi, a professor at Johns Hopkins Department of Sociology, who says there are more than 1 million a year. Those are what are known as soft statistics. But the impact of even the lowest estimate, one criminal abortion for every 40 live births, is shocking. At the recent conference in Washington, sponsored by Harvard's Divinity School, a figure of 200,000 criminal abortions a year, or one for every 20 live births, was widely accepted. Now, this is to be contrasted with 10,000 so-called legal abortions. I say so-called for several reasons. First, the advance of medicine in the past 20 years has made the purely physical reasons for abortion to save the life of the mother almost negligible. Therefore, as Judge Bazelon describes the psychiatric profession, the janitors of society, the largest percent of legal abortions are made on psychiatric recommendations. We take care of the mess. Yet as a psychiatrist, I suggest to you that there is almost no scientific psychiatric basis in the majority of cases to justify the assumption that abortion is better for the mental health of the patient than no abortion. It will come as no surprise to you that most legal abortions are obtained by wealthy women. The right of abortion, then, has not been protected with the same rigor as the right to counsel. You may, on the other hand, be surprised to find that the majority of women who seek abortion are not unmarried. Rather, they are married women with children who don't want another one. In fact, a study of a group of women who died of criminal abortion in New York revealed an average age of 25 and an average number of children they already had of 3.2. Now, a final word about abortion laws to try and help set the scene as I see it. The abortion laws of the United States, most of which came into being years ago in the 19th century, many, were principally directed against the abortionist and not the mother. Now, medical science has made abortion less dangerous than tonsillectomy, less dangerous even than childbirth. In contrast, criminal abortion in unskilled hands has a significant risk, both of sterility and of death. The laws, even if liberalized, as in the ALI provisions, would do little, if anything, I believe, to lessen the amount of criminal abortion. I'm told, for example, that in Colorado, where ALI was made law, it is just as difficult to get an abortion as it was before. Perhaps Dr. Guttmacher will have much more information on this and something to say. Now, I believe that this is in part because the medical establishment is basically conservative, and the medical criteria are not easy and not convincing. Even drastic liberalization that nonetheless deprives the woman of privacy, that stigmatizes her, that leads to delay, may not lessen criminal abortion if we can accept the Swedish experience as a fair example. There are problems on the other side. In Hungary, where abortion and contraception were widely and quite liberally introduced, the population began to drop drastically, they felt. Now, you can see, and I hope that you don't see my particular position, but I hope you can see that the issues are not simple. There aren't any simple arguments about abortion. There's no simple pro and con. And we are therefore most fortunate to have three such distinguished guests tonight. Our first speaker, the Honorable Albert Blumenthal, is a New York Assemblyman because of his willingness to espouse and pursue vital questions of social policy. He's gained a following outside his home state. He is a veteran of the legislative abortion war, where he at the very least has earned his Purple Heart and the right to command your interest tonight. Legislation regulating abortion is now being studied in many states, most dramatic in the state of Maryland, where recently a bill was proposed to remove abortion entirely from the criminal code. It narrowly failed. With this kind of legislative ferment in the air, we turn with anticipation to Mr. Blumenthal.
Thank you, Dr. Stone, Father Dryden, Dr. Guttmacher. My partner, who was a predecessor in interest here at Harvard Law School, saw the speech that somebody had suggested I might give tonight and told me a short story, I guess reminiscing to when he went to school here, of the minister in his community who had just assumed the pulpit and was making his, or giving his first sermon on a Sunday, when his wife passed the usher a note and asked the usher to please bring it up to her husband before he started the sermon. And the usher took the note and snuck up the side aisle and tried to get to the minister before he started, and he missed. He couldn't quite make it. And he snuck a look at the note, and on it was printed in very careful lettering, K-I-S-S. And the usher thought, well, now isn't that wonderful? What a lovely couple. We have a fine minister and his wife for our community. And he waited until the minister had finished his speech, and it went a little long. But he finally was through, and the usher came up with the note, handed it to the minister, and the minister looked at it, and he turned around to the usher. He said, why didn't you give me this before I started? And the usher looked at him and he said, but Reverend, you did very well. He said, I know that, but I didn't listen to my wife's advice. And the usher said, what do you mean? He said, well, don't you see what it says? It says K-I-S-S. That means keep it short, stupid. I wish that the debate on abortion had been shorter. I must admit that when I joined the legislature 5 years ago, which is not unlike joining the army, nobody ever told me that my reputation as a boy legislator would be made as the champion of abortion reform. It's even led to some thought that I might be a feminist, and no end of problems with my wife, who knows better. The problem of abortion reform, I think, was pointed up by Dr. Stone. Maybe it was part of his free flow, but he used the expression, it could happen to me, meaning him. Well, I know it can't happen to me, and I think he knows it can't happen to him. And I think part of the problem with this whole debate, very frankly, has been that a lot of men are doing the talking, and not enough women are. I think we face problems in life where we ought to be able to recognize ourselves, where we are most competent to speak. That doesn't mean we should always remain silent. It just means that we ought to be gracious enough and intelligent enough to recognize our limitations. And I haven't heard about the man who's needed an abortion yet. And I'm somewhat confused by the fact that this panel, as is true of almost every panel on which I've participated, is made up completely of men. My new counsel wrote a long speech for me. I got a new counsel. I think the leadership in the New York legislature is trying to buy me off. And it's very long, and I'm not going to read it, because I'm not very good at reading speeches. I get too nervous. I miss a word, and then everything gets all mixed up. Dr. Stone gave you the figures. And I don't think it's important for the purposes of our discussion, although Father Drining will disagree with me, whether we agree that 200,000 or 1,200,000 is the accurate figure on the number of abortions which are performed in this country each year. I think there are two other figures that are far more relevant and far more important. The first is that the figure sometimes used is that there are 8,000 to 10,000 legal abortions performed in this country each year. That is an erroneous figure. What that figure really is the number of abortions which are performed in hospitals. And that is not necessarily the equivalent of being legal. Dr. Lewis Cooper, who heads the Department of Pediatrics at NYU, testified at our hearings last year that following the German measles epidemic in 1964, he personally is aware from the records of 1,000 abortions performed in New York City for German measles, for the gross deformity which the physicians felt would follow in any baby born of a mother contracting German measles within a stated period during her pregnancy. And under New York law, which now is also the law of 42 states in this country, all of such abortions were and are illegal, because the law of New York is very plain and very simple. And it says that an abortion may only be performed where the physician reasonably believes that it is necessary to preserve the life of the pregnant woman or of the child. How that "or" phrase got in there, I'm really not quite sure, because I'm not aware of an abortion that preserves the life of the child. Of one thing I am certain, but I'm not a doctor. Of one thing that I am certain, and that is that there was no rubella or German measles abortion performed. It was performed to save the life of the pregnant woman. It was performed for a very plain and simple reason, and the reason was best described by a New Jersey court, which threw out or sustained the throwing out of a lawsuit by a young couple against their physician for his refusal to perform an abortion under New Jersey law, which is similar to New York, and described the then 7-year-old little boy is totally deaf, totally dumb, totally blind, and permanently mentally retarded. The pregnant woman, the mother-to-be, had contracted German measles during the first 30 days of her pregnancy. And this was the result. I'm not a physician, and I will leave the argument as to what is the accuracy of abortion as a cure, if it be a cure, for the threats to the health of the pregnant woman, which either a grossly deformed fetus can present, or pregnancy resulting from rape or incest can present, or a physical impairment can present, or mental illness can present. I can't, in good conscience, enter that argument, other than to say that the experts who have and who testified at our hearings made it reasonably clear that under some circumstances, all of these presented medical problems for some pregnant women. I don't think that's my function as a legislator, other than to make a finding that there's a problem, that it's a medical problem, that there's a solution that's required. What then is the course of action that we can take? Because I think Dr. Stone was correct from all that I know, and that is that the majority of abortions which occur today occur in women who truly don't want a child, however good the reasons, but primarily because they have more than they feel they can care for, or because occasionally it occurs in a woman who is not yet married and who would find motherhood an embarrassing or an uneconomic or an unhelpful circumstance. The bill which I am sponsoring, together with this year 44 other legislators in New York, will not deal with that woman's problem. We will deal only with the medical problem and the rape incest problem, and our best estimates, and they're purely guesstimates, are that we're talking about 15 to 20, maybe 25%, but I'm inclined to believe 20% of the number of abortions performed in this country, both in and out of hospitals. And on what premise do we proceed? Well, this is at least in part a law school audience. I'm going to abuse the non-law students for a moment, and I hope you'll forgive me. But I think it's essential that I do this, because I think in opposing at least this limited change in the abortion law, we are misunderstanding something that is very fundamental and very basic in our law in this country and in our social attitudes. Father Drinan will argue in a few minutes, most persuasively, he even persuades me sometimes, that we are dealing with human life when we deal with a fetus. That birth, after all, is merely no more of a birthday in the course of human development than the 21st birthday, which entitles us to vote. And that we can no more take life prenatally than we can postnatally. And he may be right, I don't know. But I do know, that certainly the right to take life prenatally should be no less than postnatally, at least where it concerns the right which all of us have, whether we be men or women, and most particularly when we be men, because we assert it as part of our masculinity, particularly the right to defend ourselves against those who would threaten us. For a while, Father Drinan's argument really bothered me. It bothered me when he and Professor Byrne of Fordham Law School would cite the case of the intrauterine transfusion performed to save the life of a fetus over the religious objections of the pregnant woman, where she, as I believe a Jehovah's Witness, said that it was improper to violate her body for medical purposes, but as a religious tenet of hers. And I had a lot of trouble with that case. And I finally came to the conclusion that were I the sitting judge, I would rule exactly the same way. I would order the intrauterine transfusion. And I decided that the reason that I would do this is that religious liberty and religious freedom is an inherent right which we all must enjoy and must be protected, but not at the cost of the life of another. And to me, that's a clear rule, and it's a respect that I can give to prenatal life without coming into an argument with the problem which abortion presents on medical grounds. And the reason that I say that is best illustrated by the example that Professor Herman Schwartz up at Buffalo Law School gave in an article that he wrote last year. When he talks about the problem of the woman who was raped, and don't misunderstand me, I am not posing the question of rape as the reason for changing the law. If there are 100 pregnancies arising from rape in the state of New York each year, it's a lot. And while my heart goes out to the women who find themselves in that situation, that is not the reason for the change. But the illustration is important. Normally, I don't know anybody in the audience to whom I can speak when I pose this problem, but this time I do, and so I will pick on my hostess for part of the evening, a very nice, pretty blonde young lady sitting up in the front row, and ask her with you to place herself on the subway platform in the city of New York, where she is approached in the most polite of terms by the would-be rapist, who says to her in plain language, "Now, madam, I offer you a clear choice. I want you to understand that it's a clear choice. I want you to understand that if you submit quietly, no arguments, no discussions, that there will be no other hurt to you. But on the other hand, if you refuse to submit quietly, and if you argue with me, there will be a great deal of hurt to you." Under New York law, and I would be reasonably sure it would be true under Massachusetts law, I'll consult the dean of Boston College in a moment, law school, my hostess would have a choice to make at that point. She could submit quietly, with no further argument or discussion, or if it were within her power to do so, she could kill her potential assailant. And was she to kill him, it would be justifiable under New York law, and I would assume it would be justifiable under Massachusetts law. So she would have a right to protect her body from harm, but strangely enough, assuming that she decided to submit, and assuming she became impregnated, that means pregnant, and assuming she was so unhappy by the circumstance that even Dr. Stone, with his dispassionate discourse on the problem of abortion, might be willing to say that it was traumatic, injurious, maybe bad for her even. No right of defense under New York law. No way to protect herself. And of course, Father Dryden will say, but the fetus is innocent. And that argument gave me a problem until I reread, and it shows you, I think I'm a pretty good legislator, and I try to read everything. When I tell you that we passed the revised penal law in New York with less than a half hour of debate, and it was twice as long as its predecessor, you'll understand that I couldn't read everything. But there is a discussion in the revised penal law which I want to close on. And it's the only part of my poor counsel, poor Roger. It's the only part of his effort that I want to deal with. And I do it because I think it's important that we place this whole question in context. And what I'm saying to you will become very clear when I read these words. One's view of abortion need not depend on one's view of prenatal life. And so, say the practice commentaries which go with the revised penal law, when they explain when physical force may be used in self-defense. And I'd like to read some of these quotes to you. Such conduct is necessary as an emergency measure to avoid an imminent public or private injury which is about to occur, by reason of a situation occasioned or developed through no fault of the actor. This is the measure of justification of defense. If Mr. Sawyer came at me with a knife, let's go on. What are some of the other things that this language would justify? Well, of course, New York is not only New York City, it's upstate. So you have to understand that the practice commentaries refer to all parts of the state. We're very democratic about how we enact our laws. It would justify, for example, breaking into an unoccupied rural house for the purpose of making a telephone call vital to a person's life. Well, all right, I mean, breaking down the door, that's not such a problem. But what else will it do? Assaulting a person who has a virulent, contagious disease in order to prevent him from going out and starting an epidemic. Well, for goodness sakes, Mr. Sawyer, you have German measles? Danger of... One step up. When you're born, I can assault you. Not before. But let's go a little further. What else can I do under New York law? Well, I can use deadly force, but provided only that I reasonably believe that another person is using or about to use deadly force against me. Well, that's the existing abortion law, abort to save life. Or using or about to use physical force against an occupant of a dwelling while committing or attempting to commit a burglary of such dwelling. Wasn't that great? This poor lady's pregnant as a result of rape, and we can't save her life, but come in and steal my watch and I can kill you. Or committing or about to commit a kidnapping or robbery. Isn't that great? Property rights are very important in New York. What are some of the other things that we can do here? Interestingly enough, and it's the final example I'll give, we can kill a trespasser about to burn down a bond. Some people have criticized the bill which we have presented, and it's very explicit. I think even Father Drinan will concede that it's far more explicit than the American Law Institute recommendations. He might even approve, as America Magazine does, of changing his view where it is sufficiently explicit. But I'd like to ask the law students here, if we're going to consider prenatal worth, to answer two questions. Does the pregnant woman have the same right to protect her health as society has to protect itself against virulent disease? And the second question is, does that same pregnant woman have that same right as the farmer does to keep his barn from being burned down? In the old country, and it makes no difference what old country you come from, there's a story about how they took care of old age problems. They didn't have Medicaid or Medicare then, and so they had a simple solution. They led the old people out to the woods, and the animals and the elements solved the problem. And there came a time in the old country, it makes no difference which old country. I understand they did it in all the old countries. Even the Indians did it. The time came when a particular old man was going to be led to the woods for his day to meet his maker. And his nephew led him across the field. And the old man began to cry, and the young man looked at him and he said, God, grandfather, he called him grandfather, please don't cry, you're making this very difficult for me. And the old man looked at him and he said, my son, I cry not for myself, but for the day that this will happen to you. I think that we have reached that stage of development. I think that medicine has reached that stage of development where we have determined that it is not enough to breathe, that there is a quality of life to which even women are entitled, and there is a quality of life which justifies all of us in saying, you don't like abortion? Don't have one. But where physician and patient say that's the appropriate medical remedy, then the law should be compassionate and understanding enough to permit that remedy to be exercised. Thank you very much.
Abortion and contraception have become popular social issues to be discussed only in the last few years. Our next speaker, however, has lent his scientific skills, his name, and his energies to these problems for many years. When to do so was to be labeled a crank or worse. Through it all, Dr. Alan Guttmacher was and is one of the leading figures of American medicine. He holds many important positions and titles. Tonight, he speaks for himself and is well qualified to do so. Dr. Alan Guttmacher.
I apologize for not being a woman, but it's too late to change at this juncture. As a physician, I'd like to survey, in a rather general way, the current abortion situation and then suggest what remedial measures might be applicable. Present abortion statutes make hypocrites of the medical profession. It is estimated that at least 70% of the illegal abortions are done by physicians, some full-time operators, others part-time workers who want to pocket quick cash. Abortion fees must always be paid in greenbacks. Professional abortionists I've known a good many, vary in character and outlook, but all have two things in common. First, their services are never free, and each thinks himself a knight in white armor, astride a white steed, intent on rescuing ladies in distress. If they didn't, they couldn't live with themselves. The fact that there are no free illegal abortions, no clinic type of setup, makes for the rankest discrimination. Abortion patients get what they pay for. A high-priced abortion is usually safely performed by a professional medical abortionist or a qualified part-time physician, frequently an obstetrician. A low fee is likely to employ some paramedical person, perhaps a hospital orderly or some nurse, and are usually a very doubtful safety. The lowest investment either results in self-induction by means of a bougie, a slippery elm stick, a hat pin, or perhaps the cooperative effort of a kindly neighbor who aids in the use of the same weapons. Even the 10,000 legal or therapeutic abortions that Mr. Blumenthal referred to, which are done in the hospitals of our country, are discriminatory. Therapeutic abortion rate among hospitals in New York City shows that there are 2.5 per 1,000 live births on the private service of the hospitals and 0.5 on the clinic service of these same hospitals. The pooled statistics of 11 large hospitals on the Eastern Seaboard showed a legal abortion rate among white patients of 2.9 per 1,000 live births and among non-whites of 0.08. I think all of us will agree that all is not well regarding abortion USA. There are three possible solutions. First, law enforcement can be stepped up and illegal abortion, the third largest U.S. racket after gambling and narcotics, can get its wings clipped. In regard to illegal abortion, state boards and medical examiners can see that each physician lives up to the exact letter of his state law. In 47 states, abortion can still only be performed to save a woman's life. A second possibility is to repeal all abortion laws permitting abortion on demand, the only control imposed by the woman's conscience. Third, existing restrictive laws could be modified and liberalized as they have been during 1967 in Colorado, North Carolina, and California. Now, how about these three propositions? What's wrong with rigid enforcement of existing statutes? First, it's impossible. People at all levels oppose our abortion laws. In a democracy, when the majority oppose a law, the law becomes unenforceable. According to the National Opinion Research Center, 71% of Americans favor legal abortion if a woman's health is endangered by pregnancy, 56% in rape cases, and 55% if there is strong likelihood that the baby may be born with a serious defect. Among Catholics, 58% favor legal abortion if there is danger to life, and 46% approve it for rape. Of over 40,000 U.S. physicians who answered the survey by Modern Medicine last spring, 87% favor liberalizing the abortion laws. Second, in addition then to it not being enforceable, as a physician, I strongly oppose literal interpretation and rigid enforcement of existing abortion statutes. Through the loophole of individual interpretation by hospitals and physicians, a small proportion of the patients who, in my eyes, merit legal abortion somehow obtain it. But if we were to tighten the screws of the law, even they would be deprived of such beneficent help. Third, there would be general opposition to the harassment or elimination of the illegal abortionist, particularly if he's safe. A good abortionist is viewed as a social necessity, as the bootlegger during Prohibition who did not dispense hooch with wood alcohol. In brazen hypocrisy, our culture has declared most abortions illegal, but at the same time we try to protect those who resort to abortion as well as their illegal perpetrators. There are astoundingly few prosecutions compared to the vast number of illegal abortions performed. According to the law, the patient herself is guilty of a felony, as are those associated with the crime, such as referring physicians. However, as far as I know, neither is ever prosecuted. In the infrequent instance that abortionists are brought to trial, non-medical abortionists may get moderate sentences, but the courts are lenient with MDs, usually putting the offender on probation or giving him a light sentence. Perhaps they are lenient because the doctor is additionally penalized by his colleagues who sit on boards of medical examiners, some members of which no doubt have referred him patients. These boards either permanently or temporarily revoke his license. The second possible solution is total repeal of all abortion laws. Let us see what's right and what's wrong in permitting the woman full choice in determining whether or not she will remain pregnant. The woman has to bear and rear the child. Therefore, who is more capable of choosing between birth and abortion? Childbirth is a personal experience, and as such, neither involves church nor state. As Mario Manis points out, abortion laws are the work of the inseminators, not the bearers. Abortion on demand would greatly speed the goal of making each child a wanted child, which would reduce the vast army of neglected and rejected children and halve or third the 300,000 illegitimate children born in this country each year. Then, too, it would take the powder out of shotgun marriages, which contribute so heavily to the inordinately high divorce rate among teenage brides. Then, too, abortion on demand would eliminate the racket of illegal abortion and therefore, in large part, get rid of this very flagrant breach of the law, which certainly shows and sows disrespect for the law. It would reduce abortion on demand, social, economic, and ethnic discrimination. Now, it would further reduce the U.S. birth rate. We now have a birth rate of 18, and if we had abortion on demand, one could not tell you exactly how it would lower the birth rate, how much more, but it would certainly bring it down to perhaps 2 or 3 points. This, some of us would think, might be a significant advantage in a population that's already growing too fast. Now, what are the arguments against abortion on demand? Some claim that abortion is murder, and therefore abortion should never be performed, or if done, only in those very rare cases in which continuation of pregnancy may cost a woman her life. Those who claim abortion is murder believe it immoral and decadent to sanction legal termination of early pregnancy because a woman simply elects not to bear a child. The lines have been drawn between the two camps, the theists and the humanists, one defending every fetus's inviolable right to be born, the other holding that those already born must be granted precedence and allowed to protect themselves against an unwanted pregnancy. The fact that 71% of Americans, including 87% of physicians, favor extension of the practice of legal abortion attests that the humanists are winning over the deists. But the fact that only 3 states have broadened their abortion laws shows that the deists are giving ground slowly and begrudgingly. I believe strongly that abortion is not murder. Destruction of an early conceptus differs in no essential from destruction of the sperm cell or egg cell before the act of fertilization. No one mourns for a sperm killed by a spermatoxic contraceptive cream or an ovum permitted to die 12 hours after ovulation because the woman from whose ovary it came knew how to prevent its survival by practicing rhythm. Sperm and egg are living cells before fertilization. Otherwise, conception could not occur. In the continuum of living matter, they remain living cells with and after fertilization. I cannot allow myself the impious thought that the Godhead rides each spermatozoan like a horseman and enters the egg cell, bestowing upon it the sanctification of the Godhead. To me, an early conception is not a human being created in God's image. It is a potential human being created in man's image. It is a mass of undifferentiated cells which sort themselves into a specific pattern according to the blueprint architected by the DNA given them through the inheritance from each parent. The difference between an early embryo and a living person is immense. The embryo has no consciousness, no life experience, no previous association with fellow humans. Therefore, equating the elimination of a mass of developing cells with infanticide, euthanasia, and genocide is offensive and patently fallacious. The charge that liberalization of abortion laws will inevitably lead to these practices is illogically and wickedly inflammatory. Has liberalization of the divorce laws led to abolition of marriage? For me, the end point when abortion is no longer permissible is not governed by intangibles like the exact day or week when the fetus is assumed to receive its soul or when the mind is thought first to function, but by medical considerations. A 26-week fetus rarely lives after natural birth, but if it does, A fetus so small, fragile, and immature has grave likelihood of serious brain damage. And therefore, to forestall this possibility, I feel a full 4-week leeway should be given in producing an aborted fetus. Therefore, I approve of abortion only up to the 22nd week, but not beyond. Like all arguments charged with such deep emotional content, especially arguments of a philosophical, moral nature incapable of proof by experiment, it's nigh impossible to convert minds already committed. Thoughtful men of goodwill who believe that abortion is murder certainly will not be persuaded by my arguments. I fully respect their opinion, but quickly confess that arguments by theists fail to change my mind. A second argument against abortion on demand is that it is likely to change basic human values. Perhaps it does, but I've seen no evidence of it. Visits to Japan and Yugoslavia have revealed no essential differences between human values and moral judgments there and in America. There seems to be the same sense of family unity with the same worshipful parental attachment to young children. Birth, marriage, and death appear to have the same dramatic importance. A third objection to unlimited abortion is the report of frequent undesirable psychic and physical reactions following its legal performance. I bring this matter up to lay a ghost. There is no evidence of this. There have been 3 important articles in the medical literature published in 1966 which have analyzed this, and there certainly is no evidence that there is any untoward psychic trauma following abortion when it is done under proper auspices. Now, despite the fact that I do not believe abortion is murder, that unlimited frequency of illegal abortion virtually eliminates the abortion racket, that I feel the woman should be the judge as to whether an early pregnancy should continue or be terminated, that easy abortion neither creates moral or sexual decadence, nor is commonly associated with or followed by undesirable physical or psychic effects, I oppose abortion on demand, at least now for the United States. There are several reasons. First, the public does not want it. According to the poll of the National Opinion Research Center, only 20% of Americans favor abortion for single women, and only 17% for mothers who do not want more children, the main seekers of abortion. In a democracy, it is safer to evolve radical social change by evolution rather than by revolution. If we succeed in greatly liberalizing all 50 statutes by 1975, then perhaps in the last decade of the century, state after state will be prepared to totally remove abortion from all legal controls. To be sure, by 1990, this may no longer be necessary. For if before 1990 a safe, effective pill is discovered which a woman can take on the 25th day of each menstrual cycle and will bring on the period 3 days thereafter, then, of course, the whole matter becomes academic. Second, I oppose abortion on demand because it reduces the necessity to use effective contraception. And as a physician, I feel it is safer physically and psychically to prevent pregnancy than to terminate it through abortion. Third, abortion on demand relieves the male of all responsibility in the sphere of pregnancy control. He becomes a coital animal without necessity to think of consequence, not far removed from the status of a bull. To be sure, the birth control pill has almost relegated him to the same brute status. But at least he still has responsibility to ask his wife, "Dear, did you take your pill today?" Since I oppose current restrictive abortion laws as well as their total repeal, I obviously favor liberalization of existing statutes. The movement toward liberalization received great impetus, of course, by the American Law Institute bill. You know the code. I need not refresh your memories about it. Now, my feeling is that the code of the ALI is too narrow. It has too much of a medical focus. It doesn't have a sufficiently broad social focus. I call to your attention the fact that Great Britain, after months of debate in a triumph for humanity and common sense, passed and signed into law on October 27, 1967, a far more liberal law than any enacted by our U.S. states thus far. It will become operational in 6 months. Abortion will be legal in Britain if two doctors agree that continuance of pregnancy would involve risk to the life of the pregnant woman or injury to her physical or mental health or to any existing children of her family. In making such a determination, I quote, the pregnant woman's actual or reasonably foreseeable environment, end of quote, may be taken into account. This bill also includes a section permitting abortion if there is substantial risk that if the child were born, it would suffer from physical or mental abnormalities. The distinctive feature of the British bill is the inclusion as grounds for abortion, risk to the physical or mental health of any existing children, including the effect that an additional child would have on the environment of children already born. This allows consideration of overcrowding, inadequate housing, strain on the mother, and similar factors. In my opinion, we should adopt what the ALI stands for, that is, maternal life or health, pregnancy through sex crime, congenital abnormalities of fetus, but in addition, I would add 7 points. One, I would favor abortion of all unmarried females of less than 18 years of age, because I cannot think that pregnancy for them is a constructive experience, and I cannot think that they will make satisfactory parents. Two, I would abort students whose courses of study leading to a degree would be interrupted by continuation of an unwanted pregnancy, because I think that to have a young woman terminate her academic career simply to have an unwanted child is a tragedy. Three, I would abort mothers already caring for three or more children, because it seems to me by the time a mother has had three children, she's a better judge than the courts or the physician as to whether she can properly take care of more children or wants more children. I would abort women of 40 or more when they become pregnant if they desire abortion. I would abort women who desire abortion who are drug addicts or severe alcoholics, women who obviously cannot give children a proper maternal environment. I'm not creating children to have them farmed out and boarded out. I'm creating children to give them a good home. And I would abort women with subnormal mentality, incapable of providing satisfactory parental care. And I would abort emotionally disturbed parents unable to cope with another child. These recommendations may seem unnecessarily specific, especially in view of the vague verbiage of the modern English law. But having practiced obstetrics and gynecology for over 3 decades, I realize that U.S. physicians seek exact guidelines for whom they may or may not legally abort. Otherwise, their timidity and that of a hospital in which they practice will incubate splendid inaction. Thank you.
Well, you can see there are eloquent physicians as well as elegant lawyers and eloquent lawyers. There are now 7 bases loaded for the next batter. Seldom does a man wear so many hats with such skill and wit as our next speaker. Priest, educator, lawyer, dean, he has made people on both sides of the Charles River and elsewhere in the country take a look at what they were doing and what he is doing. It's a pleasure for me to introduce the dean of Boston College Law School, Father Robert F. Drinan.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stone. Dr. Guttmacher, Senator Blumenthal, and ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll really have to wait to find out if this fetus is a soul, is a living being, until Bishop Pike comes, and if he can have a seance with it, certainly that proves the case. When your chairman mentioned that those who have no lobby lose out, a little cute story came to mind. I was a visiting professor at the University of Texas Law School last year, and as is my wont, I got involved in all types of lost causes. And there are no statutes protecting illegitimate children whatsoever in Texas. They have no rights against their father or mother or anything. So with the do-gooders, I went down to see a particular senator in Texas. And he listened to our case, how we wanted a legitimacy law, the Uniform Paternity Act, and so on. And then he sat back and puffed his cigar, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, all I can say is that everybody in Texas who gets something done has a lobby. And if you want to do something, then you have to organize those bastards.